This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Can 75 million Kenny G fans be wrong to love the man who inspired the smooth jazz genre? That's the question at the heart of the brilliant new HBO documentary, Listening to Kenny G. Best known for instrumental hits such as Songbird and Silhouette, the saxophonist formerly known as Kenneth Gorelick has sold 75 million records since the 1980s, and he's recently enjoyed new fame by collaborating with artists such as Kanye West and The Weeknd. Yet one constant throughout his career has been the incredible amount of bile that jazz artists and critics have spewed his way. Listening to Kenny G is, director Penny Lane tells me, an exploration of why Kenny G is the most popular and successful and best-selling instrumentalist of all time, and why that success makes a certain subset of people really mad. It's by turns funny and deep as jazz critics rail against the title character, who seems to take even the harshest attacks in stride. Lane also talks with me about her previous documentaries, including films like Our Nixon and Hail Satan, why Errol Morris is her guiding light as a nonfiction filmmaker, and what she likes about Reason, which she started reading in college. Society, she explains, needs people who are annoying, who stand outside and say, yeah, but what about this, you know? I've always identified with that kind of personality. Now, before we get to the Reason interview with Penny Lane, which you are going to want to hear, I want to take a moment to introduce today's advertiser, Inkle.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is just clickbait and fake news that nobody should waste time on. So imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, and by that I mean positive stories, are highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with over 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. And if you go to inkle.com/reason now, they're going to give you an additional 25% discount. So you get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/reason. And now, here's the Reason interview with Penny Lane.
Penny Lane, thanks for talking to Reason again.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So how did you sell HBO on Listening to Kenny G?
Well, they asked me to pitch ideas for music documentaries for this Music Box series they were putting together. And at first I didn't really know what to pitch because I don't really like music documentaries very much. I don't really watch them and I never thought I'd make one, but I really wanted the job. So I thought I would think about it. And when I think about music, the first thing that comes to mind is like just the idea of taste and how like deeply intimate that is with our like sense of selves, right, and your sense of social identity. So I really wanted to do something about that. And then getting from that to Kenny was like pretty obvious. So yeah. I basically sold it to them as an exploration of why Kenny G is the most popular and successful, right, and best-selling instrumentalist of all time, mm-hmm, and why that success makes a certain subset of people like really mad.
Right. And he sold 75 million records.
Yeah. Which, right, for people who don't know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
He's the 26th best-selling artist of all time.
Right. And he plays that straight saxophone.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
So what is it like, who, describe who Kenny G is, and then why do critics hate him so much?
Describe him like in terms of his career. I feel like everyone knows who he is.
Well, everybody will hear it, right? But yeah, so who is Kenny G to you?
To me, like, you know, Kenny G is someone whose music I never thought about once.
Right.
Like it was just sort of part of the world, like musical furniture,
right,
or wallpaper. Like by the time I came into my consciousness, Kenny G's music was already completely ubiquitous and kind of forced upon you, whether you liked it or not, which is kind of an old era now. Like, we kind of forget that we used to have music that had to like appeal to everybody because it was like at the mall or, you know, at work, and people didn't all have their own like individualized stream. So, so I thought of him as like the emblem of like mass mainstream culture, like of the sort that I hated when I was like a punk rock kid in the 90s. So that's who he was to me.
Yeah.
But I never thought about him as a person. I didn't really know anything about him or how he thinks about music or anything like that.
What did you find? Because, you know, there, we'll talk about the film in some detail. There's the whole Kenny G stuff. You hang out with Kenny G, you show Kenny G at home, at work, all of that kind of stuff. And then we'll talk about his critics. But who is Kenny G? And, is, you know, how does he come across?
So basically, like, I don't, he's so hard to describe, honestly, because I find him full of contradictions. He's super laid back, but also very high strung. He's obsessed with practice.
Right.
Like, that's like the one thing he wants you to know about him is that he works hard and he practices every day still.
Yeah.
You know, 3 or 4 hours a day.
Right. And he says 3 hours. I could do 4, could do 5, could get away with 2. But he's he is constantly iterating how he is a perfectionist and that he wants everything he does, he wants to be the best at.
He wants to be the best at everything he does. Yes. And he will work endlessly hard to achieve that. And he's making his own standards for what the best means. Like, he's not, someone else is not deciding for him what the best is. He's deciding what the best is and he's going to go for it.
Where does that come from in him? Do you have any, I mean, because he's a mysterious figure. The movie revolves around him, but like exactly what his motivation is, it's not clear.
It's not super clear. At the beginning of the film, I ask him what he loves about music and he answers that he doesn't know that he loves music that much. So the sort of standard music biopic explanation just like doesn't work. He's driven to excellence. He's driven to something like perfection. And, you know, you get the feeling with him, it could have been something else, but it happened to be music and it happened to be the saxophone, you know? He went to a high school in Seattle in the 70s that happened to have a really good jazz band, like student jazz band. And that student jazz band like went to the national championships and won like number one, right? Like
the
year
best.
After year, they were the best. And I think that had a lot to do with why he was so into it.
But
it could have been something else.
But like, his father, I mean, he talks about his father ultimately ran like a plumbing supply company store or something like that.
Thrifty supply company.
Right. And he said, you know, like, Kenny, you're going to take this over. And Kenny was like, hey, I've got this jazz thing going. Give me a little bit of time. So is it, you know, was he terrified that he was going to be selling plumbing fixtures for the rest of his life?
I don't think he was terrified. I think he just had another idea. You know, he wanted to do something else. I don't really know. The film is not about that. I was not really trying to plumb the depths of his psychology necessarily. There's not a lot about his personal life in the film because I don't care. I was interested in, although why is he so popular and why does that make people mad? And what can we learn about the music by listening to him talk about art, like his ideas about how to make music and why, and his ideas about beauty and excellence are all important to me.
Right.
But I don't really know much about his like soul per se.
Well, he doesn't seem to have a soul, right?
Well, up for debate.
I mean, like, not in a normal way, particularly for a jazz musician, because at early on you ask him, you know, okay, who are like the jazz greats? Who do you like? And he doesn't really seem to be that interested in that question.
No, he's not. I mean, he, if you ask him about musical influences, he will talk about Grover Washington Jr. And that's pretty much it. And I'd never heard of Grover Washington Jr. So for people that don't know who he is, he was like a kind of proto smooth jazz saxophone player. Like he played like pop covers of like popular songs. And it's a very beautiful, relaxing 1970s sound. So Kenny started out wanting to sound like that. And then he kind of like morphed into Kenny G, but he never, he's not like, he's not making art in conversation with anybody. Like, he's not thinking that way at all. He's not like, well, you know, there's this tradition and that tradition and where do I fit into that? Like nothing like that.
So Kenny G starts out in a band, in a jazz ensemble, right? And then he
gets Jeff Lorber Fusion.
And he And there's a bunch of great pictures of him in various bands where he's wearing kind of like space suits in the 70s
he's
and things
some
like that.
Questionable fashion choices over the years.
But then he gets seen by Clive Davis. Can you talk a little bit about how that factors into Kenny G's career?
Yeah. I mean, if you ask Kenny why he's so successful, he'll say Clive Davis. And it's interesting because, again, it harkens back to a very different era. So Clive Davis, again, for those who don't know, it was this kind of very famous record executive. And he's the head of Arista Records. And he saw Kenny playing with the Jeff Lorber Fusion and thought, oh, he's got like the it factor. Why are you laughing?
Because the way Clive Davis, before he was at Arista, he was at Columbia and he signed like Janis Joplin and Blood, Sweat and Tears and Santana. And then he got fired. Then he comes back to Arista and he finds like Whitney Houston. And he's like this kingmaker, but he is like a schmaltzy, like he's a cartoon version of an entertainment mogul, right?
Well, I think he created the image of an entertainment mogul.
Right. He's so, like, this, you, I don't know what it is, but you've got it. And he's old. He's 1,000 years old and fat and bloated. And he's like, and then I said, Kenny G, we're going to make a hit record type of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Clive spotted Kenny and gave him a record deal. And what's amazing is that then they proceed to make 1, 2, 3 records, all of which are pretty much commercial failures. And they're sort of trying to figure out like what to do with this skinny Jewish kid from Seattle who plays the saxophone in a kind of flamboyant way that apparently makes the audience crazy. And well, what are we going to do with him? And so they were kind of trying to different formulas like, well, let's pair him with this producer and that songwriter and whatever. But what's amazing about that to me is that, again, it's such a different era of when that type of Clive Davis figure would like invest in and like really invest in an artist year after year and record after record. Like the idea that there's a record label that big that kept giving him the next record despite the fact that he was failing essentially is really interesting.
Yeah.
Very different. So he didn't have a hit, Kenny, until his fourth album. That's when Songbird came out.
Right. And I can hear it in my head right now. and it's like I kind of it's
one of the
it
great melodies of all time.
It seems to be. But then Kenny G also tells a hilarious story about being on The Tonight Show. And this again a past era, right, where like going on The Tonight Show could make you or maybe break you, but definitely you could become a star. And he was told that he's only can play one song and he was supposed to play a hit song at the time that he had, but he plays Songbird instead. And what happens?
Well, it's an amazing story because, you know, again, if you're me, if you're coming to Kenny G from my point of view of like someone who just thinks of him as who has traditionally thought of him as like essentially a corporate product.
Right.
Like that's how I never imagined a person, you know, making artistic choices. Like I just imagined somehow like a corporation like created that music and then forced it down my throat in the 90s. But he is a person, he is making artistic choices. And all throughout those years at Arista, he's trying to find his sound. He's like really trying to figure out what his sound is going
to
be.
And he even says he tried to sound like Grover Washington Jr. He wanted practice for hours and just couldn't, he doesn't sound like him.
No, he sounds nothing like Grover Washington Jr.
But he becomes comfortable with his own sound and perfects his own sound.
Yes, and so Songbird was a great example of that because on that record, they had like a vocal track that was the single that the record company wanted. And then Kenny had made this song called Songbird all by himself. Like he played all the instruments, he recorded it himself, he mixed it himself. It was like his work of art. So he gets asked to go on The Tonight Show to play the single. But then because he changes his mind at the very last minute and tells the band to play Songbird and he gets up on stage and he does this totally rebellious thing. You know, I mean, it just completely upends your ideas, most people's ideas about who he is. Right. I mean, it was a completely rebellious act that made his career.
Right.
And it could have ended it because the booker was mad, the people on the show were mad, his management was mad, the record label was mad, everyone was mad. But then people heard Songbird on The Tonight Show and really liked it.
Yeah.
So then it sort of became a hit. It was the most unexpected hit. Like nobody saw that coming.
Right.
This was not a sound that people were creating or asking for, or it just kind of came out of nowhere. And he was cool for a while. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so he's like this sort of new sound of jazz, and he's headlining at jazz festivals, you know. But then once he has his first album that's like insanely Breathless, I think he sold 12 million records, which is insane. Then the jazz people started to really not like him.
Yeah. So what is, and the concept of smooth jazz, which was, you know, that was kind of built around him, right?
So Kenny's so successful, and he has Songbird is a big hit, but then he has another hit and another hit and another hit, which is unusual, again, because there's really never been an instrumental artist like that.
No, there's Chuck Mangione, who had Feel So Good.
One song.
Yeah, and then like Herb Albert way, way back in the 60s
had one song.
But then had Rise and sometime in the 80s or late 70s.
And Herbie Hancock had Watermelon Man, one instrumental
Rocket,
hit.
I think also. Yeah. But,
so anyway, so it was very unusual for an instrumentalist to kind of come back with these hit after hit after hit. So the radio stations were playing lots of Kenny G because everyone loved it. I mean, everybody loved it. This is like the important thing to explain. Like,
this is like an alternate timeline in, you know, in the Man in the High Castle or something. Okay. So where Kenny G, Kenny G and the Axis powers win World War II.
So he's very popular. And then, and then like radio stations, there was a kind of like, how do I put this quickly? There's a confluence of like a moment of intense market research and growth in the radio industry that kind of comes together to create a new radio format, which hadn't happened in like 30 years.
And can I, because you have a bunch of critics or commentators on things, and I want to get some of the critics who hate Kenny G, but one guy you interview is named Alan Kepler, and he's talking about the birth of this. And he said, you know, what we did, we ran focus groups, and we let the listeners take over.
Yeah.
So this
give the people what they want.
Isn't that kind of amazing?
I mean, that's what market research does. I mean, people like, you know, have a negative reaction to it for reasons.
Right.
But it is just about that. It's like, what do people like? Play that. Yeah. So they would run these, you know, hooks by people, hundreds of songs, and every market research group would come back like all the Kenny G songs were just like the most popular. Right. Everybody liked Kenny G. So then these radio stations create a format called Smooth Jazz, which is literally a format they made to build around Kenny G.
Yeah.
That was the only reason the format existed. And it became very popular because it was popular in offices and waiting rooms and, again, these kind of public shared spaces, which it was like, it was just groovy enough that it didn't feel totally lame in elevator music, but like it was very even. There was nothing too loud. There were very few lyrics that might offend somebody.
The ladies loved it.
The ladies loved it.
Can, as a lady, what, you know, what's there to love there?
I don't know.
Okay, well, let's you know, so Kenny G becomes this market behemoth in jazz, right? In some form of jazz. And jazz, you know, was once a very, it was popular music. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, over the past, I don't know, you know, 40 years, it's been this rarefied elite form that you, you know, like you can't understand jazz. You've got to go to college and graduate school to understand jazz. Jazz critics hate him. And like the jazz critics, I think, and I don't know if this is your intention, but I see them as the villain of the piece because they are like, here's a guy who has made jazz new and fresh and appealing to millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the keepers of the crypt. They're the vestal priests or something of the of the great temple. They all hate Kenny G. You know, what does Ben Ratliff of the New York Times, what does he hate about Kenny G?
Well, I think it's just the utter void where most of the ideas and grit and texture and nuance would be in music that he would like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time with Kenny and it kind of didn't matter how many different ways I asked him what he was up to when he was creating these songs. He was just like, I don't know, it's pretty, like, I like it.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like that's about it. Like there's really, so as a fellow artist, I mean, it was hard to understand that.
Right.
Like most artists have like a whole set of things they're thinking about, like who your audience is and who you're in conversation with and what histories you're drawing on and, you know, how are you innovating? How are you making something new? You know, and that Kenny just isn't engaged in that. And I think it's, I think his, oh, I'll tell you what Ben Ratliff hates the most though.
It's the hair.
It's his utter lack of interest in jazz.
Right.
Kenny G does not know anything about jazz. I mean, he'll kind of say, oh, the jazz greats of the 50s and 60s. And I bet
But he can't name them literally. He looks at a painting of a bunch of greats, and he's not exactly sure who all of them are. But he's like, oh, they're all great.
They're all great. I like them.
Yeah.
You know, but there's no engagement. Right. So for Ben and for many people, one of the things about jazz is this, you know, conversation that happens over time. Like, what other form is there with these ideas, with the idea of standards?
Right.
Right. Where like we're going back and back and back, and we're still kind of playing the same songs in some cases. Maybe that's why jazz isn't so popular anymore. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's what a lot of jazz musicians are doing. And the idea that Kenny, rather than doing that, would make an album called New Standards that's just his songs.
Right.
I think that I can see why that makes people mad.
The critics have some good, you know, criticism of saying, well, he's not interested in tradition. Kenny G emerges as kind of like the anti-Bob Dylan, who is now spending the last several decades of his career going deep on all of his roots and like the whole American songbook, where, you know, Dylan is singing Frank Sinatra, he's singing, you know, older musicians. He's always been invested in the history and tradition. Kenny G is like, no, I'm creating new standards. And he even goes so far as to discover Stan Getz. Could you explain who Stan Getz is and how Kenny's next big hit might be a duet with Stan Getz, who died years ago?
Oh, it's already out.
Yeah.
Kenny really does like Stan Getz, or at least he likes one album by Stan Getz called Getz for Lovers. And he says he listens to a lot. And so he wanted to create a duet with Stan Getz, who's, you know, sort of popularized bossa nova music. Beautiful, soft sound. And so he collected samples of Stan Getz's saxophone parts that he got from other songs and then rearranged them and engineered them to play an original Kenny G composition. So the song, I believe, is called Legacy. It's out already. And it's Kenny playing with like this zombie Stan Getz.
But he even talks about how like they share solos. They swap off on solos, and Stan's solo, which is written by, not quite performed by Kenny, but it's written by, and then he chops up all the individual notes from existing Stan Getz recordings and then plays a solo he wrote for Stan Getz. And at one point he says, and this is kind of charming, he's like, I would have taken it this way, but Stan, he would play it this way.
Yeah.
And so
Kenny describes that as like when he was trying to write like Stan Getz, he described it as like, I would have gone this way, which is normal and happy, but Stan would go this other way. That would be like, I don't know, mysterious. And it's really sweet.
Yeah.
Like he really is. I should say this too. He is a sweet, wonderful person. Like I haven't said that yet. And it's really important. And he puts a smile on my face. Every minute I spent with him was fun and joyful and great. He is a supremely self-confident person, which can rub some people the wrong way. I have found people are rubbed the wrong way, like in proportion to how insecure they are. So people who are insecure and lack self-confidence find him very upsetting.
He is incredibly irrepressible, right?
Yeah.
Where he looks at the, you know, like the bright side of everything, but he also...
He's relentlessly optimistic, hardworking.
This is the hard work. Can you talk about that? Because this also seems, you know, he is... One thing he constantly stresses is hard work and practice, practice, practice. He signs on his high school wall, you catch him, he's signing on the wall of fame, and he's like, you know, find what you love and then practice, practice, practice. He talks about putting in the reps. What is that something that bothers jazz critics?
I don't know if that specifically bothers people. I think that maybe it bothers some jazz critics that his sum total kind of artistic statement is work really hard, practice, and like pretty.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's troublesome to people. But in fact, I mean, his work ethic is nothing but inspiring. Like, it's only good. Like, you know, he could have applied himself to like much worse things, you know, than like getting really good at the saxophone. And I found it really inspiring and charming. And it made me wonder if I would ever work that hard in my life to get good at something, you know? Probably I wouldn't. Most people wouldn't.
Yeah.
So for him, like, you know, he's like very systematic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, I'm gonna make an apple pie. What is the best apple pie? Like, I'm gonna try butter, I'm going to try shortening, and then I'm going to compare, and then I'm going to do it again. And, you know, and
at one point, he talks about being on tour when he's 80s and his 60s now. And,
yeah.
And he's like, you know, I'll have 20 more years of practice. That'll be 20,000 more hours of practice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is...
Which for him could only mean he's better.
Right.
Like, it's a very simple equation. Like, number of hours practicing is that many number of hours better. Yeah. At playing the saxophone. I think that's what he cares about more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, some of the critics, as I was saying, and as you were saying, that, you know, the critics raise serious questions. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, he's not interested in jazz's tradition.
Which, just to be clear, is offensive.
Right.
Like, I mean, if for anyone who cares about that art form, and I'm not a big jazz person, but I think it's, let's say it this way, it's offensive, especially in an era where you accessed music in a record store and there was limited shelf space. Mm-hmm. And if half the jazz shelf space is Kenny G, then like, I agree with them that that's like probably a problem, right? Because, but it doesn't really apply anymore, I don't think.
Right.
Like, it doesn't matter in the same way now if he is jazz or isn't jazz. Like, we don't access music that way anymore. These labels make no sense.
Well, these guys come across as very uptight. Right?
And
because
they're
guarding, you know, it's like I spent a lot of time learning. I know all of the interplay of this and that. And who is this Kenny G guy who comes along and sells more records than all of the jazz people together
combined
times 10? And he's jazz. You do talk to one critic, though, who actually came into jazz through Kenny G. How is his criticism or is his connection to Kenny G more interesting?
I thought all of their connections to Kenny G were interesting. But wait, I also want to say, like, I appreciate that you're going, like, hardcore populist with your analysis.
Right.
Like, well, Kenny's popular, therefore...
I'm not saying therefore he's good, but it's like he gets dismissed mostly because he's popular.
I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
And so what I was trying to do with the movie was, like, it was really, like, deal with the music.
Right.
I mean, you know, its formal qualities, let's say. I used to be an art professor, so, like...
Right.
What is the, like, what are the techniques? Like, what are the forms? How do they come together? What are the ideas? Like, what is it in conversation with?
No.
And it really is music that is pretty difficult to analyze because there's kind of nothing there. Like, the more you look, the less is there.
Well, and this is one of the, I think one of the most, insightful criticisms is one of the critics says, I think it's Will Lehman says, you know, this, a jazz ensemble is kind of a call and response thing. It's equal parts. Everybody's playing against each other. And that Kenny G, it's just Kenny G. It's just the saxophone. Everybody else there is there to support him.
Yeah.
He says it's not
sex,
it's masturbation.
The most quoted line in the movie.
Right. But that guy is also a ridiculous character of a jazz. But like, so why should jazz have one meaning that is described by some like old white guys who are like really upset that this Jewish guy from Seattle is selling so many records and is like, you know, fucking with their little pond.
Yes. I agree with you that that is a question the movie raises. Yeah. And I can see it both ways.
Right.
I basically just tried to like, and I do this with all my films usually, like I'm trying to play it down the middle. I'm trying to like lay out a kind of like banquet of discussion topics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm like trying to make them look as delicious as I can, but I'm not sort of telling you which ones to eat, right? So like if this movie for you is about like jazz, the jazz police, like protecting the gates against the barbarians.
You know, defund the jazz police, okay? All jazz police are bastards. But
that's
I agree. No, I agree that that's, you know, that's my read of it. But you also, one of the most interesting parts of the movie, and I think this is probably partly related to your being a professor, at times you do look at the reception. Like, what is the audience? Like, we know the critics don't like Kenny G. What does the audience get out of it? Because you show a lot of interaction with fans and people, you know, and maybe in its purest form are the number of people who get married to Kenny G songs.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Well, I think it's so important because I focus this film on this conflict between like, let's call it the masses and the critics, the critical class, the cultural elites, you know, I think that it's easy to forget that most people, when I tell them that I made a film about why people hate Kenny G, are like, who hates Kenny G?
Yeah.
Everyone loves Kenny G, which you laugh, but it's true. You can go,
you can go to any country
on this planet, and you will find masses of Kenny G fans. Every country, every age group, like every ethnicity, like anything you could name. It is like Disneyland. It's like going to Disneyland, going to his concerts. Like, that's how broad the demographic is. It's everybody. Everybody loves Kenny G. So when I'm talking about the hate, it is like this tiny little speck of humanity that includes probably my friends and your friends, but like not much beyond that, you know?
But so what do the people like who love Kenny G?
Yeah.
What do they like about it?
I think the most important thing is that it's music that is useful. Mm-hmm. It's useful in their lives. I think life is hard.
Yeah.
And there is nothing wrong with like wanting something to relax to after like your 10 hours at the factory or, you know, whatever image you want to use for that. It's useful music because it doesn't have lyrics. It doesn't get in the way. Yeah. You can put it on in the background. Mm-hmm. So people study to it. They meditate to it. They run to it. Mm-hmm. They make love to it. They get married to it. They've used it to put babies to sleep. They've used it to, anesthesiologists use it before surgery. It helps get the heart rate down. The Chinese government uses it to send people home at the end of the workday. It is a supremely functional music, which is interesting because it's referred to by another critic as musical furniture, which I think is actually pretty apt.
Right.
You know,
but he means that as a slam.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, no, you know what? Like, we need
people,
furniture.
People like furniture.
Yeah, I like sitting on, you know, in chairs, not on the floor.
Yeah. And so, and I think, you know, it is music that is easy to listen to, and it is catchy to some extent. It's nice.
Yeah.
Makes you feel nice, unless it makes you angry, in which case, that's a different outcome.
And you know, when people see the movie, I mean, the clips of Pat Metheny, the ultimate kind of jazz police guy, because he's a practitioner, he's not even a critic, who hates Kenny G.
Oh,
who says he'll, like, if he sees Kenny G, he's going to punch him. You know,
he says he's going to wrap a guitar around his head. It's just pretty violent.
That
what you're referring to was in the year 2000. So now over 20 years ago, Kenny had done another zombie duet with Louis Armstrong.
Right.
Louis Armstrong?
Well, but this is the critics are like, it's Louis Armstrong.
I think
everybody else,
I think
the
it's
people
Louis.
Call him Louis.
I know.
Yeah, he's known as Louis.
I know, but I think it's Louis. Anyway, so I'll say Louis with Louis Armstrong.
Right.
And he did a duet with a kind of video projection of Louis Armstrong playing What a Wonderful World. And Pat Metheny, who is a very well-respected jazz guitar player, he was outraged by this. And I think a lot of people in jazz were outraged by it, but Pat Metheny happened to like take to a message board that probably he thought 30 people would read, you know, because it's the year 2000, like internet, like what's the internet? So he writes this like screed, basically, and so many words, he's like 10,000 words. And he just goes off, you know, he's like, this has been all piling up for him. Yeah. Like, you know, it's time someone said something about Kenny G and what a terrible person he is and how he's perverting jazz and all this stuff. And it's a kind of a funny letter, but it's also very incisive in a certain kind of way. Like, it's certainly passionate. So yeah, Pat Metheny declined to be interviewed for this film.
I think he's done his best work. Those clips that you have.
The letter that we have and the clip that we have is plenty.
Before we continue with the recent interview, I want to introduce you to BetterHelp Online Therapy, one of this podcast's sponsors. Are you feeling stressed out, run down, anxious, short-tempered? If you are, take the time to take care of yourself by going to BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/TRI for the recent interview and start talking to a licensed therapist who won't judge you but will listen and help you with your problems, whatever they are. That's BetterHelp.com/TRI. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with a therapist in under 48 hours. If you don't like your first therapist, you can switch to another, all without the hassle of driving across town and sitting in a waiting room. I know it's a great service because I used it myself. If you need to talk it out, and these days we all need to talk it out, Go to betterhelp.com/TRI and get 10% off of your first month. And now, back to the Reason interview with Penny Lane.
We'll come back to Kenny G at the end, but I want to talk about the rest of your work.
Because sure.
Reason interviewed you a few years ago when your incredible documentary, Hail Satan? Came out. That is a film about a group of Satanists who are pushing for equal representation of religious icons in the public square.
Yeah.
And they would go around to places that had put like the Ten Commandments out or whatever, and they would say, well, we want Baphomet. They are, you know, polysexual, you know, part goat, part human icon, also represented on like on the steps of City Hall.
Yeah.
Is there, what's the connection there? Is there a thematic connection?
I think so. Yeah. Well, the joke way of putting it would be to say, like, after I made a movie defending Satanists, you know, I thought to myself, who do people hate more
right.
than Satanists? But that's not really true, of course. It's more like I think what I'm good at and what I'm trying to do often with my films is find really entertaining, funny ways to talk about really serious issues that I don't think a po-faced delivery right. would get a big audience mm-hmm. for. I mean, you know, it's like, who needs a serious movie about religious freedom? It sounds boring already. But a movie about...
I blacked out. Yeah.
But a movie about, like, a bunch of, like, crazy goths, you know, yeah. who, like, mm-hmm. run around, like, causing trouble is mm-hmm. super fun. And so you can, like... And I want people to be able to change their minds. I want mm-hmm. people to be willing to change their minds. And I love that. I love the feeling of finding out that I'm wrong. Not everyone does. Mm-hmm. I love it. So, like, for me, I'm trying to engineer moments where it's, like, destabilizing for people. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought a Satanist was this kind of person, but it seems like I was wrong. Or, you know, I thought In God We Trust was our motto from the beginning, but it right. seems like I was wrong. Like, that kind of stuff, I think, is really valuable. And if it's funny and entertaining, which are, like, top two right. values for me, then people are, I think, more open. They're more interested in change. They laugh. They don't even know they're changing their mind. They're having too much fun.
But your work, and I want to talk about R. Nixon next, but your work is often kind of, it's characterized as being light or funny in kind of a negative term, right? Because we want art, like real art is drama. Real art is tragedy.
Well,
real
sure.
art makes us
If you're talking
sad.
About like who wins awards, sure.
Yeah.
But I get much yeah. bigger audiences than oh, okay. so, depressing documentaries.
Yeah, but I mean, so
I am the Kenny G of documentary.
Okay,
basically.
that's what I was going for. Now that we can stop talking.
No, I don't think it's yeah. been negative for me at all.
Okay.
I think, in fact, documentary suffers from a problem of like just way taking itself way too seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think audiences get really tired of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, finding a niche where I'm kind of like not doing that.
Right.
Like I'm not doing the kind of like, you know, social justice, you know, lecture mm-hmm. movie. I think people are just like, oh, what a breath of fresh air. At least so far, that's what my
right.
career has told me.
Another major documentary you did, and I guess this aired on CNN, was Our Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that project and how does that kind of fit into your oeuvre, or does it continue, or
yeah.
does it anticipate the themes that come later?
Sure. Our Nixon was made as my first feature, so it came out in 2013, and it was made of about 30 hours of Super 8 home movies that were filmed by three of Nixon's aides, so Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Chapin, which are right. names people might know
right.
from the Watergate scandal because
yeah.
they were three of the top guys that
right.
went to prison.
Did all of them go to jail?
Yeah, they
I
all
think?
Went to prison.
Yeah. yeah.
For conspiracy, for lying to the feds.
And it is, which
for obstruction of justice.
Yeah, which maybe shouldn't be a crime, but we'll get to that. But it's what's amazing about that is the footage. I
yeah.
mean, because this is, you know, it's not quite like, you know, Hitler After Dark, but, or, you know, the personal side of Hitler, but it's this weird
You know you're saying Hitler and not Nixon, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, I know that because I'm saying, but this is Nixon. You know, there's a whole generation of people who thought that Nixon was worse than Hitler because,
totally.
Well, whatever. But, I mean, it's just amazing. And it's all footage. It's all contemporaneous footage
yeah.
of Nixon and his henchmen, his minions, his
right.
plumbers.
Who are like, you know, having fun at work. I mean,
right.
like, that's the, to me, what I loved about the footage was, you know, I had grown up, I'm only 43, so
yeah.
like, Nixon's before my time, right?
Right.
So I'm inheriting this story about Nixon. And without really realizing it, I had kind of pictured like this kind of grim, you know, dark place. And I think it came from like Oliver Stone movie, literally, you know? So it's like, I'm picturing like people in dark rooms, like, you know, plotting, but then you see this footage and it's like, just like normal people, like having fun, like, you know, hanging out with, you know, it's like Henry Kissinger joking around with Haldeman and like whatever. And it's just very jarring.
Pool hijinks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's no like villains in home movies. Right. Like home movies are just so utterly kind of everyday and banal, and they're all kind of the same. So they don't have like great footage of Nixon because they're not pointing their home movie cameras at the president.
Right.
Like they're filming each other and goofing off at work and going on cool trips and like filming out the window of cars, you know, and like Europe and stuff. So it's really jolly and it makes you feel the excitement and the joy and the hope and the optimism of these very young men who were young.
Yeah, now they're all in like their 20s and early 30s.
Yes, now I can see that because I'm now 43.
Yeah,
they were young, you know, and they were just in the White House and they were like, this is going to be the greatest presidency of all time.
Right.
And the movie, you know, is powered by this kind of dramatic irony because we know the ending and they do not, right? So that makes it really easy to like take pot shots at them, like, ha ha ha, I know the future. But I think it's really haunting because I'm constantly like in a state of thinking, oh my gosh, like whatever story I think I'm living right now could be completely rewritten in retrospect by events beyond my control.
Right.
And I'm not making a claim that the Watergate guys were innocent or, you know, but it was clearly a big mess.
Yeah.
And it was clear to me that not any one of them knew the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
So in retrospect, it looks like this whole organized conspiracy. But from looking at the contemporaneous day-to-day tapes and everything else, it was very obvious that it was just a mess. Like, I mean, there was conspiracy in it, but it was not like overall, it was not a plan.
It's, I mean, the conspiracy in a lot of way gets retroactively
put on. Because we make it all make sense.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we want it all to make sense because we need to put a paragraph at the top of Wikipedia.
Maybe also true of, you know, of musical tradition, like to some degree.
I mean, exactly. Yeah.
Who are the documentarians that you find, you know, that have influenced you the most? Or are you like Kenny G, your hero, just born, you know, surfing in on a seashell off of Zeus's brow or something?
For me, I would say Errol Morris was and is my kind of most guiding person. And I think it's because I really admire his rigor and his sense of humor. Errol Morris always has a sense of humor, which people forget because he's so rigorous.
Yeah.
And he's so committed to the pursuit of truth, even while he acknowledges how difficult it is to achieve.
His movies, in a lot of ways, are always about finding the truth. And, you know, a book that he authored called A Wilderness of Error. I mean, that it's just, it's really hard to kind of actually understand what's going on.
Yeah, he's really, I think, just an epistemologically rigorous filmmaker, which I admire. And by the way, is not true of most documentary filmmakers. That's what I've realized. Most documentary filmmakers, sorry to say this, do not care that much about truth, actually. They care more about maybe they would say justice or something like that. So I had the same experience in academia. I went into academia thinking like, these are people who like care about the truth. And then, you know, 10 years later, I was like, no, I mean, not so much. Then I moved into documentary kind of with the same naive attitude and then only gradually realized that like, it's not everybody who's like equally invested in truth seeking as kind of like their primary.
Is it that they're not invested in truth seeking or they define truth in different terms, so that truth is justice, or that we can never know the truth, so we might as well tell the story that advances our aims?
Sort of the latter, but not, I don't think it's even that.
What do you have?
I think it's more about like knowing what the outcome should be or knowing what the point should be, and then just kind of like engineering.
And it makes it kind of boring art, right? Because then you're moving you just have to move the plot along to get to the end as opposed to kind of trying to figure out what you really think about something.
I think so. And I don't mean to say like my way of making films is the right way. Yeah. There are lots of films that are kind of advocacy films or whatever that I really like and admire. It's just not what drives me. Mm-hmm. And I've come to understand that there are different top tier values for different documentarians. So I'm attracted to Errol Morris also because he is interested in how people think. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like his whole career, is you got these like close-up pictures of people mm-hmm. looking directly at yeah. you, and you're watching them think, and you're right. watching their mind move. I love that. Like that yeah. for me is like cinema. And most people, when they think of interviews, they think of like talking heads, and it's kind of just right. information delivery. But
or
that
it's
is
an
like
interrogation, right? Where you're going to yeah. break somebody down. Whereas his kind of signature movies, or the interview movies, whether it's Robert McNamara or Don Rumsfeld or Steve Bannon, he kind of lets them talk and yeah. talk and talk. I mean, he doesn't, it's rare when you even hear him ask a question.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. So yeah. Errol Morris is great. And then the other film I would just say off the top of my head is Exit Through the Gift Shop, mm-hmm. which came out in 2011. And I honestly, it was so influential on me. I can't believe it was only 10 years ago.
This is about Banksy.
This is a Banksy film.
Right.
About this street artist mm-hmm. named Mr. Brainwash. And it is so funny. Mm-hmm. And it's like so deep. And I remember watching it on Netflix, and Netflix used to have reviews. Mm-hmm. Remember that? And you know, it was like this very well-reviewed film. The mm-hmm. audiences loved this film. And like I would say like 1% of those people liked it for the reasons I liked it, mm-hmm. where they were like, this feels like a meta documentary about these like ideas about like manipulation and like, is it all a hoax? And I can't tell. It's like, okay, 99% of the reviews were just like, inspiring street art documentary, mm-hmm. like he's a funny guy, you know? Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's what I want to do. Like, I want to make films that like the 99% can enjoy as just mm-hmm. like fun. And like, maybe they're not thinking that hard. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're just like, Kenny G, he's pretty cool. Didn't know that, whatever. Yeah. But that there's something there for like the few who are very engaged with this mm-hmm. form and like want to think more deeply about the documentaries they're watching. I guess that's what I'm trying to do.
I'll share something between us that is
just between us.
Yeah, well, that happened between us. That is probably more embarrassing to you than me. But we met at a book party that our mutual friend Nancy Rommelman, who's written for Reason and the New York Times and everybody in between. But you confess that you are a longtime Reason reader. Does your art have an ideology? Not a politics per se. I mean, you're yeah. not, you know, you're not trying to, you know, convince America to stay out of World War II because you're part of the Communist Party before, yeah. you know, Hitler invaded Russia or something like that. But is there yeah. an ideology there, or how does your thinking about the world influence what you're doing?
I guess like, okay, so first about Reason, yeah. I started subscribing to Reason when I was in college and I went to Vassar. So mm-hmm. it like came in the mail.
Right.
And
in a brown paper bag or something like that.
I would yeah. like put it underneath yeah. all my other right. mail to bring yeah. it back to my dorm room. But it, honestly, like in high school, I mean, so it goes back a long time, because in junior year, I remember we had like a politics class and you were supposed to choose like Democrat or Republican mm-hmm. to like be part of the debate or whatever. Right. And I just like didn't like it. I just didn't know what to do, because I was like, I don't want either one. And my teacher was like, okay, well, there's this other thing. And I think on some level, I probably was attracted to it because it made me feel special.
Right.
Like I'm yeah. the one person here yeah. who doesn't want to go along with the crowd. And I've always felt like that kind of mm-hmm. person, which is part of why I identified with the Satanists so much.
Right.
I was like, well, yeah, society needs people who are annoying, who stand outside and say, yeah, but what about this? You know, mm-hmm. and like, I've always identified with that kind of personality. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is somewhat of a kind of libertarian right. personality type. But as far as my ideology goes in the films, I think to the extent that there is ideology there, it's very much about humility. I think these films are about humility. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a genius and I should run the world, but like I would never want to do that, because I actually don't think that my ideas are better than other people's ideas. I mean, I think I have ideas about how I want to live, but I'm not interested in imposing them on other people.
But you do want to share them with other people, because then we can have a conversation
yeah, yeah.
about
so,
it, or maybe come
yeah.
up with a better way of
totally.
Figuring things out.
Totally. And the Satanist film was directly political.
Yeah.
I mean, it had
right.
to do with like politics today, whereas the Nixon film yeah. was a history film.
Right.
I mean, it's nothing to do with politics at all. It's yeah. like more about historiography or something. But for me, you know, that intellectual humility, I think, is very important. And I find it endlessly surprising how many people really do feel attracted to the idea of telling other people how to live. Hmm. And I genuinely just don't understand. I don't.
Yeah.
I've never wanted to do that. I don't really understand. Like, I don't understand that.
Do you think that is mostly, is it temperamental? Is it generational? Is it gender based? Or,
you know, where it's temperamental, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's temperamental. I think you're probably going to have a pretty consistent number of heretics percentage wise throughout culture over time. That's what I think.
One of your or your next big project that you're working on has to do with you donated an organ. And of course, so you...
A mystery organ.
Yeah, well, you donated a kidney, right? You know, and you, you know, obviously you lose your libertarian credibility because you gave it away instead of holding out for the best offer. But what, how is that movie going to play out? And how does that kind of, you know, what are you hoping to talk about in the context of talking about kind of kidney donation or organ donation?
Yeah. So the film is called Confessions of a Good Samaritan. And it's about, my decision to donate one of my kidneys to a stranger. So someone I've never met and will never meet and won't know anything about, which is something that...
It would be very ironic if that person ended up killing you though, right? I don't know how you would find out, but that would be a great ending.
Maybe it would come out after my death. I don't know.
My God, it's a perfect match.
And so I heard about the idea that you could donate a kidney to a stranger probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I immediately knew that I wanted to do it. It took some time to do it, like just scheduling in life and stuff, but I didn't need any convincing. It was an immediate moral intuition that it was obvious that I should do this. And the reason I ended up making a film about it, which was not my plan from the beginning, and still a little questionable on my like desires list. I'm not sure. We'll see how the film turns out.
Yeah, what happens if it bombs?
Well, so you're like, well, that way, I know. But anyway, but so I decided to make the film because I thought there was an interesting psychological mystery there, because the people who donate kidneys to strangers pretty much all say the same thing, which is, I heard I could do it. I made a calculation, which is very simple. It's called the principle of comparable sacrifice. Okay, so there's this person out there who's dying, a slow, painful death. They're strapped to a dialysis machine. They're strapped to a dialysis machine. They usually can't even work. They can't travel. And they're dying. And they could be not dying. They could be restored to a nearly normal quality of life with a donor organ. There's 100,000 of those people in the United States at any given moment. Most of them are going to die on that list. So if you, potential donor, are willing to undergo a pretty safe procedure, I mean, it's major surgery, so there is risk involved. But it's pretty safe. You're in the hospital for a day and a half, and then you go on with your life like it never happened, like you have no quality of life change. Then to me, and to some people, a very few people, it's obviously the right thing to do to donate. Like, it's just really simple. It's like once you've put it in your head like that, it's hard to get out. So I was not like overwhelmed with empathy or something. It was more like it felt rational. Like it was just like, obviously, like, you know, this sacrifice is so outweighed by the good. So anyway, that was why I made the film, why I'm making the film, because I wanted to understand the ethical issues around organ donation, including compensation, which we can talk about, but it's not the focus of the film. It's like really much more about the technological controversies. Like at every stage of organ donations development, there have been people screaming from the rooftops that this is going to be the worst thing that's ever happened to humanity.
This is unnatural.
It's against God's will.
But and then
an entire field of bioethics is basically invented because of organ donation.
The standard libertarian line is, well, you know, if we just compensated people, we create a market and then, you know, everything's good. Well, we'll have like, you know, you'll go to Chipotle and kidneys will be one of the options or something like that. You're skeptical of it.
I used to think that way.
Yeah.
Because it, again, logically,
right,
it's very simple. Yeah. Pay people like hello.
Yeah.
But there are a few countries where compensation is legal. And I guess, how do I say, like, it makes the giving, I guess, selling, it makes the selling of a body part seem like a pretty desperate act done by people who don't have better choices. So it puts the whole thing into a frame of like, you know, kind of almost shame. And so it's not that people wouldn't do it. It's that the feeling about the whole thing would be so different. Right now, organ donation is kind of suffused in this angelic light of altruism. And I think that's why people do it and feel good about doing it and are happy they did it and then tell other people to do it. Perhaps if we were in, and this is not about exploitation. I'm not using that word. So I don't think that's the right frame. It's more just like, I think that there's a qualitative change in culture that would be more negative than positive, even while we were saving more lives. Meanwhile, we don't have to do that because technology is going to solve this problem a different way. So it's sort of like beside the point, like long before we ever think it's a good idea to compensate donors, which I will say we should at least reimburse them for their expenses, which we do not do. And I lost so much money doing this. Minimally, I think reimbursement would be nice. And I generally agree with Sally Satel that if we could create
of course, she's the recipient of several kidneys.
So she would say, like maybe again, 10 years ago, she might say, pay people, right? Create a market. But she also has changed her tune on that. I think maybe not for the same reasons as me. Maybe she's just responding to political reality, which is that that's not going to happen, right? So if that's not going to happen and we're worried about exploitation or people making rash decisions in a moment of desperation, there are all kinds of ways we can get around that. Maybe we can give a $50,000 tax credit that's spread out over 10 years.
Right.
So that really is not going to solve your problem.
Disneyland fast passes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like there might be like things like that that we could do that I would support. But as far as just like creating an open market, I think it would be probably a mistake for our culture at this time.
You know, to bring it back to Kenny G, listening to Kenny G, you know, part of this is about the way that markets value art versus critics or you know, elites and things like that. And that often is at loggerheads. I mean, you have bands like the Beatles who kind of just slip that noose because they're like, you know, extremely popular and then also, you know, critically acclaimed. But that's kind of rare. But when it comes to documentary as an art form, or not even as an art form, just as a genre, you hear a lot of people talking about how, you know, documentaries can't get viewed anymore. People don't make them. You know, it's hard because the market doesn't reward that. Is that true? Is
no, that accurate? That's not even kind of true. Okay. That was true 20 years ago. But there's, I think, because of the success of reality television, I think that audiences have developed an insatiable hunger for documentaries.
Why do they like documentaries, do you think? What do documentaries give that you know, narrative film.
Reality. I mean, it's just that simple. Like, you feel like you're in contact with the world. You know, this is about historical material reality that we all share. And I think that that is very compelling. And I think reality television showed that to people. So we can, as documentary people, look down on reality television, but I think it has everything to do with the appetite that's been generated and revealed. So I would never have left my tenured professor job if we were not in like essentially a boom, a nonfiction boom. It wasn't possible to make a career making documentaries. It was very rare that you could make a career making documentaries even 10 years ago. But there are a lot of people making a career at documentaries now.
Would you agree in your work? I mean, this is something I see, but I'm also conscious of, like, you know, that I, like Ahab, I see what I want to see. I see Moby Dick everywhere, but your work, and this is also something in Errol Morris, I think, where you get a vision of a world, but then the filmmaker very generously kind of, you know, foregrounds the fact that you're putting a particular frame on things so that you, even as you're exploring something, you're reminding people that this is a particular take. This is not objective reality that, you know, is not problematic.
Yeah. I don't know that I would put it in those terms. I think I would more say that I'm asking people usually to consider issues from different points of view and to acknowledge that probably they're going to gravitate toward one of those. So you might watch the Kenny G film and think the critics are villains. You might watch the Kenny G film and think that
Kenny G is history's greatest monster.
Yes, someone else would watch it and find him odious and unacceptable. I am thrilled to make a film that allows for those readings. When I made R. Nixon, my first film, I remember very clearly getting an award from Michael Moore. And he is like describing the movie that I made. and why he was giving me this award. And it was like, I was like, whoa, that's that's what you thought it was about.
So he was watching a very different movie than
I
the
thought.
One you, yeah.
But I kind of love it. Like, yeah. I think I'm humble. Like, I really do. Like, I really am not trying to tell people what to think, mm-hmm. truly. But I do think that there are things that I'm passionate about foregrounding that I want to force people to contend with. So with Hail Satan, that was the misconception that we live in a Christian nation. Like, mm-hmm. that's important that people understand that that's simply not true. Like, that's not what the founders had in mind and blah, blah, blah. So for me, that was important to foreground. But, you know, at the end of the day, if what your takeaway is we should change the laws to make it more Christian, like, I guess that's okay, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, as a final comment about Kenny G or question, you interview a Marxist critic who teaches at Bard College, and you kind of, I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed about the movie, and yeah, I'm against the critics here, you know, but you kind of, over time, they kind of break down and they have to admit that a lot of their initial disgust or distaste with Kenny G is just, you know, it's, they think he's beneath them.
I would say it's contingent. You know, for someone like, just to interrupt you quickly, someone like Ben Ratliff acknowledges in the film that when he thinks of the music, he thinks of a corporate attempt to soothe my nerves, right?
Right.
Like, he's acknowledging that he's experiencing this music in a context,
right.
Same as mine, which mm-hmm. is why I put his at the beginning, because I'm like, mm-hmm. that's where I came from, like a corporate attempt to soothe my nerves. That's what Kenny G's music. But then by the end of the film, you know, we flash forward to the current day, young people hear this music for the first time.
And Kanye West, who is the ultimate, he's the Beatles.
Tastemaker.
He's an incredibly big selling artist and critically acclaimed.
Yes, and a kingmaker.
Yeah.
So when young people hear this sound now, they're not hearing the mm-hmm. sound of the dentist appointment.
Right.
They're not hearing like that thing that you were forced to hear over and over and over again at the mall. They're not hearing anything other than like a cool 80s sound.
Right.
So what I'm getting at is that for me, I think by the end of the film, I want people to think about the contingencies about how they're receiving this mm-hmm. music. How much of your reaction to this music is in the music? Mm. Like, it's actually about like the reverb and the composition and the, you know, and how much of it is really about the culture around it. If Kenny G had different hair, would you maybe think about it differently?
Yeah.
Probably.
And
you know?
There's a great moment where, you know, it comes up because he's been accused of this, that if he was black, he wouldn't have, you know, he wouldn't have had the same career. And he kind of grapples with it. He's like, well, you know, I would have gotten those same record contracts and stuff like that, but maybe I wouldn't have been as big.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which is an amazing moment because he genuinely hadn't really thought about it before.
Right.
And it's, as an interviewer, you like live to see people realize something.
I'm hoping to pull
right
one out
of
here.
You.
Yeah. Yeah. But so the Bard College critic, who's a Marxist, who writes for Jacobin magazine and whatnot, and you kind of box him into a place where like he has to ultimately kind of say, well, you know, like 75 million Kenny G fans can't be wrong. These are the lumpen proletariat. They're the, you know, the equivalent of coal miners. And so what they like must be okay. And then you have him listen to music and the contortions on his face where he has to say, as a good Marxist, like this must be good, weirdly, because the market has certified it as loved by millions. What is going on in that moment?
Well, I think that it's interesting that you said he's boxed in. I agree with you. I think that analysis—
Because he clearly hates this music.
He doesn't like the music. I agree with you. Sorry, John, if you're listening. I don't believe you at all. He's also like an avant-garde composer. Like, I've heard his music. It's like not KG, you know?
Yeah.
But that's fine. Like, I'm not saying he's lying. I'm saying I think he's trying to hear it the way someone mm-hmm. else might. And that's what I was doing as well, right? So, like, I think it's actually really moving. But I do think that Marxist analysis, it doesn't get you all the way because at some point you have to deal with the music. You can't just be like, it's a commodity like any other or like an idea. No, I mean, there's art here. There are choices being made. What is it? And does it lack, you know, something that you think good art has? Mm-hmm. That's a question that you have to deal with, you know? And again, different people have different answers to that question. But for me, separating the questions, is it art? Do I like it? Is it good? It's very important. because those are like three different things. Yeah. People tend to make it all one, but I think there's a huge amount of issues with each of those questions. And I think that my critics are trying to separate those things as I force them to listen to this music and talk to me for hours on end.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. Listening to Kenny G coming out on HBO. Penny Lane, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Google, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.